Back at it for you on Tuesday, January 7th. The notion of a good guy with a gun stopping a bad guy with a gun, last shown in an averted mass shooting at a Texas church by a churchgoer who was armed and took out a gunman. We discussed that episode with a nationally known journalist who covers gun rights and gun-related issues. Joe Scully joined us in the 5 o'clock hour. He runs the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, representing truckers big and small. We talked again about revenues that could be brought in by a truck-only toll plan here in Connecticut. But also, we heard from New Haven attorney Norm Pattis regarding his representation of Fotis Doulos. He was arrested on Tuesday, January 7th, along with his former girlfriend and an attorney in connection with the disappearance and alleged murder of Jennifer Farber Doulos.
The bond for Mr. Doulos is $6 million. We were hoping to make an arraignment appearance this afternoon. That's not going to be possible. He will be arraigned tomorrow morning in Stamford rather than Norwalk, and we hope to make bond at that point.
Has anything in particular happened that they pulled the trigger on this today?
I beg your pardon, sir?
Anything particular happening that they pulled the trigger on this today?
You'd have to ask them. I mean, my hunch is that it was a long and thorough investigation. I believe they waited until they thought they could make their best shot, and let's see what it is.
You talked to Mr. Doulos. What's his mindset?
I'm not going to talk about my conversations with Mr. Doulos.
Is there some new evidence, sir?
I would hope so, because based on what we've seen thus far, there was insufficient evidence to get to second base.
Norm, were you expecting these charges?
Mr. Colangelo made clear it wasn't a question of when, so yes.
What?
Am I relieved that they've finally been charged? You betcha. We've sat for months waiting to and listening to speculation, and now we get to address the proof, and we are confident about our case, and we are confident about our odds. We said long ago, bring it on. They did. We're here. We're ready.
Communications Director for Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. You've read his pieces, perhaps, online in the Chicago Tribune, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Seattle Times. He is widely considered an authority on firearms, concealed carry, and all that. Dave Workman is here. Dave, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's very kind of you to have me. Usually I'm not welcome in your part of the country.
Dave, let me tell you something. Connecticut is funny because if you get outside the cities, where the only guns that are firing usually are urban violence, you know, gang violence here.
Yeah.
And it pains me to say that. But if you get outside of the cities here and you go to, say, the eastern part of Connecticut or the Northwest Hills or anything above Hartford or out on the shoreline here, there's a very active gun community. I have friends of mine. I don't own a firearm, Dave, but I have numerous friends of mine who are in gun clubs. There are competitions all over the state. So Connecticut in that way, Dave, is not as anti-gun as people think. Even next door in New York, you go to upstate New York, there's a bunch of people that own guns there.
Oh, I've been to upstate New York. In fact, I've been to Connecticut, too, and Massachusetts, and I've traveled back there off and on a little bit, up to New Hampshire and Vermont. And I know there's a pretty active firearm Second Amendment culture back there, and you know, good for those people. They're not harming a soul.
Well, yeah, and in fact, post the tragedy we had here, of course, with that sicko Adam Lanza at Newtown back in 2012, you know, with some of the gun restrictions that were added here in Connecticut, none of which would have made a change there, the Second Amendment folks out of the eastern part of the state, they were plenty upset, and they were able to flip a good amount of state house seats. So, you know, Dave, even in a blue state like Connecticut, the right to keep and bear a firearm and do it legally really cuts across politics a lot of times.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
I wanted to have you on today to talk about, and somebody from your organization, Dave, to talk about what we saw the other week in Texas. We had, this suburb in Texas.
Yep.
They were having a Sunday church, as millions of people do, and they were live streaming their services, as many churches do. And then all of a sudden, some slug nutty with a rifle walks in. He had apparently, appealed to the church earlier. They wanted money. They didn't give it to him. But Not only did the gentleman who was the assigned security guard jump into action, but, you know, you saw a bunch of guys and maybe a couple of gals start to pull their, their armaments from right when they were in the pews. And Dave, it's kind of restarted the discussion again about the quote-unquote good guy with a gun.
Yeah, and it's funny that this comes up. I just did a book here that came out in September with Alan Gottlieb at the Second Amendment Foundation called Good Guys with Guns. And I watched the 51-second video of that church shooting, which came with sound, by the way. So it was really an interesting thing for me to watch. I'm a firearms instructor, too, in addition to being a journalist.
Yeah.
And I was very careful to watch, and I slowed the speed of the thing down so I could watch what happened. Seven other people, in addition to Mr. Jack Wilson, who fired the killing shot on that guy, seven other people, including one woman that I could tell, drew sidearms and moved in on the guy after he was down. And in the course of that, they were very careful to kind of usher people out of the way to get them out of the line of fire. So I think that what this amounted to was really a testament on the effectiveness of armed self-defense by private citizens. It was a phenomenal shot, considering everything that was going on at the time. And Jack Wilson, I haven't had a chance to talk to him yet. I've reached out to him for an interview.
Yeah.
He fired that shot over the course of, I think, about 45 feet. That's my estimate. And one round, it was a moving target, and he hit this guy in the head. And, you know, people who are fairly good with a handgun can do that. I went down to the range to try it, and from a draw, I was able to draw and fire and make a headshot on a target within 6 seconds. But it's not something that everybody can do.
Yeah, and you know, Dave, and the guest is Dave Workman from thegunmag.com. Also, he's a spokesman for the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. You know, Dave, I pointed that out to friends of mine, both in the business and who are gun owners, and I'm not even a gun owner, but I said, boy, that's pretty good. And they said, well, that's only because he has a law enforcement background. I guess he was a retired FBI agent or something.
No, I don't know where that got started.
Yeah.
He was a reserve sheriff's deputy for
okay.
a while,
yep.
but he is a firearms instructor,
mm-hmm.
and he had a gun shop and a gun range down there until it burned down a couple of years ago, but he's still pretty active, as can be understood by just watching the video. He made a really good shot in the midst of pandemonium, and it was just awful that this guy walked in there with a short shotgun. He fired one round and he killed a guy who was actually reaching for a sidearm. You can see in the video that he's kind of fumbling, struggling to get his gun out. I think that attracted the gunman's attention. He fired and shot that man first. Then he turned his attention back to an usher at the back of the church, shot him, and that allowed Mr. Wilson the opportunity to draw his own sidearm and fire the fatal shot.
You know, Dave, it's frustrating to me because I have friends and I say, well, geez, look what that guy did, having a firearm in church and everybody else. And I always have people that say, well, yeah, but that was lucky, you know, because for every person that stops a crime, X amount of people get killed somewhere else. What's your response to that?
Nonsense. I think there's research out there that shows that armed private citizens defend themselves anywhere from 500,000 to about 2 million times a year. Most of the time, a shot isn't even fired. The mere display of a firearm convinces the bad guys that maybe they ought to go somewhere else. It's a myth that has been perpetuated and unfortunately just believed out of hand by the media. That armed private citizens are more of a danger to themselves than anybody else. And the church shooting video puts the lie to that. You've got seven people in there who are armed. They've got drawn handguns. They all moved in coordination. Nobody fired a shot. They kept this downed guy covered. There was no panic shooting that you see in some of the TV shows or hear about, you know, allegedly involving private citizens. No, they moved in there. There was one round fired to take the guy down, and everybody else maintained their distance and their muzzle control, and they moved in and were able to stop the violence before it really got out of hand.
Dave Workman is the guest. Dave, and hang on. We'll do a quick break, then right back to you. When we come back, I'm going to ask you to respond or what you thought may have happened if there were not people, any sort of security or just regular citizens in those church pews in Texas a couple of weeks ago. Dave Workman is the guest, communications director for the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. You also can check him out at The Gun Mag, THEGUNMAG.com. More with Dave Workman straight ahead. Traffic and weather together on the 6s here at 416. And we are talking good guys and I guess good gals with guns as well. After a couple of weeks ago, you saw what could have happened in that Texas church. It was being live streamed just like, I guess, any other day. Sunday services, guy walks in with a short shotgun. He's taken out with one shot from a congregant in the back who was a firearms instructor, but he was at church that day doing security, and six or seven other people drew their weapons. We continue for a few more minutes with our guest Dave Workman. He edits the gunmag.com, writes for several other publications. He's communications director for the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. Dave, I can only imagine what the carnage may have been like had no one in that church have been armed. And with all due respect to our fine men and women in law enforcement, had somebody just been able to dial 911 and then they would have had to wait.
Yeah. And, you know, I've got a lot of friends in law enforcement. And quite honestly, they do the best job they can faced with the constraints that they've got, you know, politics and budget and all of that. But when seconds count, police are minutes away. And in this case, seconds did count because this whole thing was over in 6 seconds. Now, if that guy had faced an unarmed church congregation armed with a 12-gauge shotgun, which it appears to be a 12-gauge pump shotgun, I'd hate to guess at the number of people who would have been killed and wounded in that sanctuary. If you remember the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard shooting of a few years ago,
yes, yep.
That guy used a 12-gauge shotgun. And at first, the responding authorities and a lot of the press thought that he was armed with some kind of a semi-automatic rifle. But if you're using, say, double-aught buckshot, in a room that big, you can hit a lot of people with one shot. And my guess it would be that we'd still be experiencing the after effects of that, maybe some funerals, or and people would still be in the hospital. But, you know, thank all the gods and all the heavens, depending on your faith. This man, Wilson, in the back of that church, did what too few people have an opportunity really to do. They prevented a greater tragedy from happening, and I think he can rest at night thinking that and understanding that he saved lives.
And Dave, we also see now a bit closer to where I am here in Connecticut, in New York City, where you have now these anti-Semitic attacks going. You openly, and I said bravo to them, there was a picture circulating of some Hasidic Jews with semi-automatic firearms out there and some shotguns as well, you know, saying to hell with the law, we're going to protect ourselves.
And, well, who can blame them? You know, I live in the West. I grew up out here in the Pacific Northwest during a time when, you know, we have, I guess, transitioned, you know, the population up here. We've got a lot of people who've moved from, say, New York, California, New Jersey, where they're not used to a firearms culture. But I grew up around guns. Everybody I know owns a gun. And – it's a different philosophy where you realize that the sheriff or the police may not get there in time, and you're really on your own for whatever happens in your immediate future if there's an emergency. I've held people at gunpoint, and that was because the sheriff was miles away. And, you know, I didn't really care to do that, but it was either that or some tragedy might have happened. Fortunately, I've never had to shoot anybody. And, you know, I guess we can all be thankful of that, too. But this is a situation where people, if they've got good training and understand their legal rights and responsibilities, they can make a difference.
And, you know, Dave, I guess everybody is still watching that Supreme Court case that I've discussed with a couple of other gun experts where, you know, the state of New York scrambled to change a law regarding where legal gun owners in New York, and there are some of them, it's a pain in the rear to get a license, but you can do it, as to how they could transport their guns. And, you know, the city went, holy smokes, we better change the law. But, you know, it still is, as you well know, at the Supreme Court, and should the court rule a certain way, that could send shockwaves to a lot of the anti-gun parts of the country.
Well, that would certainly break a lot of hearts out here in Washington State. And I say that facetiously. I look forward to seeing some kind of a ruling from the Supreme Court on this issue. And there, I think, are four other Second Amendment cases that are now at least under consideration by the court to either hear them or let lower court rulings stand. But I think New York, and I've written this, I think New York knew all along that what it was doing in New York City was unconstitutional, and that's why they burned up the midnight oil trying to change that law after the high court decided to hear the case, because they knew they were wrong. And otherwise, they would have defended it, and they say, hey, our law is good, we're going to defend it. No, our law states, no. We better change it.
Hey, Dave, in the final minute we have left, what I do see now, and obviously you're watching this too, a lot of areas saying, well, maybe we'll do this a back doorway and we'll tax ammunition up the wazoo. We're starting to see that now a lot, aren't we?
Yeah, I've seen, in fact, they passed such a deal out here in Seattle, Washington, and in the 3 years since that thing took effect, the murder rates have gone up, not down. And I've written about this, too, which makes me really popular with all the liberals in Seattle.
Oh, they must love you.
Oh, yeah. What can I say? I look at the facts and write about it.
Let me guess. They didn't pick up your tab at Starbucks. I'm just guessing, Dave. Is that right?
Well, fortunately, I don't drink coffee anyway, but they wouldn't even pick up my bar tab. So.
All right, folks, you can check him out. He edits thegunmag.com. Thegunmag.com writes editorials all across the country, and he is the communications director for the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, talking to us from Washington State. Dave Workman, Dave, thank you. We appreciate the time.
Well, it's very kind of you to have me. You guys take care back there.
Thanks. We'll try Dave Workman. Happy New Year. How you been?
Paul, good evening. Great to be with you.
Well, thanks, buddy. Appreciate that. You issued a news release earlier today, and you have brought into question, and I see there's some other outlets now doing this as well, some math that you say doesn't quite add up if the governor went with his trucks-only tolling plan. What's your contention here, Joe?
Yeah, here's where I got that from. So I was listening to the radio town hall that he did this morning on another station, and he said very definitively $186 million. That's how much money truck-only tolls would bring in. I went back and I looked at the financial pro formas that were put out back in December, and they said truck-only tolls would raise $230 million. So I'm thinking, that's a big difference. Are we talking about less revenue now?
Mm-hmm.
If we are, that's going to pose a problem regarding paying back these low interest federal loans that this whole thing is banking on. It would be a big problem if the state does not have the money to pay back federal loans. I don't think we should be messing around with the federal government. So because of that, I'm saying that this is questionable math. These numbers are not adding up. We can't just be winging it and using questionable, at best, maybe made up numbers at worst, to go for a federal loan. Just not something we should be doing here.
And Joe, you're right, because any sort of a loan, people say, well, it's the federal government. They just give you the money. They don't care about it. No, no, no. When it comes to roads, and I think this is one thing the public is being educated about, Joe, in this whole process, because I know I am, they want some sort of collateral. It's like you or I buying a condo or a home or whatever, a piece of property. You know, the bank is going to ask you and I, well, Joe, what's your income? Paul, what's your income? Let's see your pay stubs and let's see if you can afford this. So you're right. That drastic of a drop in income, if it's trucks only, is good, could be a determining factor here.
You know, that comparison to a mortgage is one that I made the other day, too. If the federal government bureau that administers these loans or bondholders look at what the state is either able to produce or not able to produce, if that's the case, and they question it, why would they approve a loan? Why would they buy the bonds? And I've said that would be like, you know, a mortgage lender approving you for a mortgage when they know you're about to lose your job. It's risky for them. They're the ones who are going to lose money and not get paid back. That would only benefit, you know, the mortgage applicant, or in this case, the state. But I think at the end of the day, why people should truly care about this is if truck only tolls does not produce enough revenue to pay back either bonds or federal loans, they're going to have to get that money from somewhere else. So does that mean car tolls? Now, they say they'll never toll cars. Does that mean an income tax increase or a sales tax increase? You have to get it from somewhere.
Yeah.
That's why it's key that these numbers are accurate. And I'm pretty confident in saying I don't think there's any reliable information that is behind these numbers.
And Joe, let's Joe Scully, let's just say this. Supposing it is not 230, it is 186. And at baseline, Joe, for your organization, the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, you and your membership, whether they're big companies or small companies, saying, and maybe some out-of-state trucks, who know, but the bottom line is that's an additional cost to truckers, local and otherwise, of $186 million a year. Somebody, Joe Scully, has to pay for that.
Well, absolutely, and I was shocked watching some comments in a press conference today where leaders dismissed that. They said, no, truck tolls will not have any impact on the cost of goods. Now, let's think about this. Everything that we buy was on a truck. Everybody admits that. There's no disagreement on that. So these trucking companies, which are small business members that we have here in Connecticut, they are like any other business. They have to figure out what are their costs to them before they figure out what do they have to charge their customer, because they got to make a little bit of money at the end of the day. Otherwise, they're not going to exist. So when you have a new cost, you have to adjust and you have to raise your rates. I guess not everybody gets that. A lot of people do. We've got supporters on our side. I was talking to Tony Wong, Senator Tony Wong, who's from your area today at the Capitol, and he's with us. He gets it. But unfortunately, I'm just shocked that people think, no, the trucking companies will just absorb it.
Yeah, you know, Joe, that drives me crazy when people say, well, they're making money. They should just they should just bite the bullet. I'm like, who the hell are you to say that? Joe, I'm telling you, when people say that, I find that worse, Joe Scully, than somebody who says, well, they're going to have to charge more for their product. Okay, I don't agree with that, but at least they're upfront about it. These arrogant people who say, well, you know, they can just absorb that cost. Really? That drives me crazy.
You know, I think, look, if people are, if they're not in the trucking industry, they may not realize. That's why I'm happy to have this opportunity to come on and talk about it. One is everything was on a truck, and when we have to pass our costs on, ultimately we pass them on to you. So just because you may not hit a toll while you drive to work, you're still going to be impacted by this. But two, the taxes and fees that we pay do not, many of them do not apply to passenger cars. So again, passenger car owner may not realize that trucks pay the 12% federal excise tax, the heavy vehicle use tax, the unified carrier registration fee, which can hit $66,000 for 1 year, the tire tax. None of those things apply to cars. And when you add all those things up, plus the state taxes, one truck pays $17,000 a year in taxes. Now, does that not sound like a big number? I think it does, but I guess to people in Hartford, it's not enough. And I wonder what number would be enough? You know, $20,000, $25,000 a year for a truck? What is it?
Mind-boggling. Joe, listen, try and keep your sanity. I know this is going to ratchet up in the next few days again, but, you know, knock one back, knock a couple back at night. Try to relax when you're back and forth to the state capitol, and we'll keep in touch. Joe Scully, Motor Transport Association of Connecticut. Joe, as always, we'll keep in touch. Thank you.